Okay. I have a confession. I have never watched a single episode of The Sopranos, and I have never seen any of the Godfather films.
And yeah, I know that.
Well, I'm just not into those types of movies.
You co-host an organized crime podcast.
Yeah, because I like solving mysteries. And speaking of mysteries, one mystery inspired this episode.
Well, I know what you're going to say.
Yeah, you do. I stumbled across a newspaper article about 23 paintings recovered in June of 1982. It was all done furtively and struck me as something Laura's dad, Richie, would do. I sent her the article and asked, how did Richie feel about Salvador Dali?
And all I could think of was that damn giant Dali coffee table book from Rizzoli's that he bought me. And I was thinking that he was trying to encourage my love of art.
Hey, didn't he get it for you as your birthday gift?
Yeah, I became obsessed with surrealism. I was busy building frames, stretching canvases, smearing gesso over everything. I had all kinds of different sizes. It was my shot at being a surrealist artist.
Yeah, I doubt anyone wanted to steal your creations, though.
Definitely not. But in my 11-year-old brain, Dali had nothing on me. But speaking of art theft, what about the heist at the Louvre?
Hey, I've been tweeting about it all week.
I know, it caught your attention, but the two beauties got snatched up trying to flee to Mali and Algeria.
How uncinematic of them. Okay, moving on. I know you want to dive into the 80s today, but we have to go back to the 70s just briefly before we get into today's topic.
Every freaking time it's the same stories. I lived through the 70s and I loved it, but you want to keep me there.
I have my reasons, so trust me, and at least we're out of the 60s.
That's a plus, I guess.
Okay, so in 1975, the Boston Licensing Board started cracking down on establishments in the combat zone.
Don't be so puritanical. Establishments, you mean strip clubs.
Hey, my family were Puritans. I can't help it. Ugh,
no comment.
It's just born that way. Okay, let me get to my point. In an effort to shut them down, they enlisted the help of the Organized Crime Task Force. U.S. Assistant D.A. David Toomey was paired up with Special Agent Zip Connolly to help with the investigation.
And what does that have to do with stolen dollies and a Brinks truck being taken down?
Hey, if you would stop interrupting me, you'll find out. The following month, Miles Connor went on the lam after failing to appear in court in the Woolworth Estate theft case.
Okay, and?
9 months later, Toomey was involved in securing the return of a Rembrandt that was stolen from the MFA a week before Miles went on the lam.
Oh, speaking of that, Anthony Amore's book comes out on November 4th, which is this coming Tuesday, and it's The Rembrandt Heist, the story of a criminal genius, a stolen masterpiece, and an enigmatic friendship. So it's about Miles and the Rembrandt. All right. Didn't we cover that, though, in a previous episode about the whole Rembrandt thing, or I'm confusing Rembrandts and sleeping bags with Dad and his assortment of paintings wrapped in bed sheets in the trunk of his car with an occasional Rodin statue rolling around?
Yes, we did. We talked about it in the hit parade of 76, and we said we would come back to it in this episode.
Okay, so I'm not hallucinating.
No, you're not. More artwork that included pieces by Picasso, a Braque valued at $13,500, and a Matisse valued at $12,480 was recovered in September the following year. The collection of lithographs and etchings were stolen from the Pucker Gallery on Newbury Street in Boston on St. Patrick's Day in 1974.
Just before my fifth birthday.
Hey, you and your birthday and art heists.
Always insinuating things. You know that the Pucker Gallery is still there and they have an amazing collection.
Well, you should go visit when you're back east on vacation. Other pieces, including a Gainsborough and a Monticelli recovered in the raid, had been stolen from the Brockton home of the late H. James Stone. The FBI arrested four men: Benjamin Lambert of Milton, Edward Brennan of Mattapan, Richard Kirkwood of Weymouth, and John Paul Kerrigan, whose mom remarried Fred Schuele, the uncle of Deborah Davis.
Is that the same Kerrigan who was the uncle of my illegitimate cousin who passed away before finding out that he was the kid of one of my uncles?
Okay, that was really confusing, and I forgot about that saga, but
sorry.
No, you were spared there. The spelling's different, actually.
Okay.
The feds also recovered jewelry that had been stolen from a home in Cape Cod, which was in the possession of Kerrigan and Kirkwood. Joseph Giacalone was named a co-conspirator of Lambert's in the Brockton robbery. He operated the Fancy Watch and Crystal Company at 333 Washington Street. Each of the four men and Giacalone received sentences ranging from 2 to 3 years in early 78.
Do you think Dad gave those guys up?
Well, that is always a possibility. Now, fast forward to 80, when Kirkwood and Lambert alleged that they had been kidnapped by two men posing as law enforcement. Kirkwood claimed that one of the kidnappers sounded like undercover FBI agent Joseph Buchka. The FBI denied the allegation, but interviewed Miles Connor's former in-law, Thomas Cass, who had by this time become a government witness after he escaped from the Dedham courthouse in June of 1980, only to be scooped up by the feds shortly after. I guess he thought he could make a deal with the Stateys, but either realized that they couldn't or wouldn't give him what he wanted, so he escaped to the feds instead. They promptly arranged for him to go into witness protection. He had been serving a 10 to 20 year sentence for a home invasion.
And just a few days later, Miles was acquitted of the January 1975 bank heist in East Milton Square. Thomas Speranza was the prosecution's main witness. That's also linked back to the hit parade of 1976.
And that brings us to the December 1980's Brinks heist outside of the First National Bank on Center Street in Jamaica Plain, which netted the thieves $153,000. Witnesses said that three men clad in ski masks, two armed with handguns and one with a shotgun, jumped out of a blue station wagon in which they believed there was another person, possibly a woman, still behind the wheel of the vehicle. The car was found still running not far away.
Well, they may have gotten away, but their freedom was short-lived. Four of the participants were arrested a week later, including Stephen Rossetti and Louis Royce. At Rossetti's East Boston apartment, the police discovered a ski mask, a .38 caliber handgun, two-way radios, burglary tools, and the icing on the cake, $8,000 in cash stuffed into a stereo speaker. The .38 was the one that had been taken from one of the Brinks guards during the heist. There was also jewelry from a B&E that had taken place the previous month. Each of the foursome that also included Joseph Smith and Kevin Whitford were held on $250,000 bail, but they soon made bail and were back on the streets the following month. I want to note that Mark Rossetti had been sentenced earlier in the year in February to 13 years in the Concord Reformatory for assault with intent to murder for the beating of a Massachusetts state trooper, William Johnson. Now, the story goes that William Johnson had hit him with his motorcycle, and that's how this whole thing ensued. Mark's cousin, Michael Rossetti, was sentenced to 5 years for assault and battery and by means of a dangerous weapon, in this case, a shod foot.
Makes me think of Jimmy Modarano in the shoe.
Wasn't that with Margaret Sylvester, or is it somebody else? Yeah, Margaret Sylvester. Okay.
Okay, well, we'll get to the 13-year sentence in a bit. Meanwhile, in late February of 81, acting on a tip, Royce and the Rossettis robbed a family in Newton while they were away on vacation. They stole $50,000 in jewelry plus 26 paintings, including pieces by Dali, Marc Chagall, and Joan Moreau. According to Royce, he wanted to keep the art at his place, but the Rossettis insisted on keeping it under their control in East Boston. And it was Stevie Rossetti who started looking for a buyer almost immediately. And it seemed like luck was with them when he found one. Royce reluctantly agreed to the meeting, but even after showing the loot to the fence, they couldn't get a deal. Months passed before the fence contacted him, saying that he had a buyer. They arranged the exchange for the last day of August, a little over 6 months after the Newton break-in. But while Ralph Rossetti and Royce waited for the fence to show, a team of FBI agents surrounded their car and arrested them. The feds recovered three of the pieces that Royce and the Rossettis had stolen, but 23 were still missing.
The following month in March, Miles was convicted in the double homicide of two women in Jamaica Plain back in 1975. He had been accused of ordering Thomas Speranza and John Stokes to stab the woman to death because they had witnessed Speranza murder a man outside of a barroom in Rossi earlier that night. Speranza then killed Stokes in Walpole State Prison the following year. As we mentioned earlier, check out the hit parade of 1976 for more on that.
By July, the infighting between the various authorities made the prospect of Miles having the case overturned highly probable, but they promised to cooperate and put their grievances aside. Now, let's get to the end of 81 and one of my favorite stories. At a quarter to seven in the morning on Saturday, December 19th, Richie Devlin signed himself out of prison on a 24-hour furlough. A little over an hour later, he and Louis Royce robbed the Rockland Trust Company at the Hanover Mall, throwing a truck wheel through the window to gain access to the building. The Brink's pickup was scheduled for 9 a.m., and the bank employees were still counting the deposits from the night before. Royce, Devlin, and another accomplice fled in a stolen vehicle. Devlin went back to the can to wrap up his sentence and was released the following month. Technically, the heist remains unsolved.
And that was a great story. Also that month, Miles was acquitted in the 1974 holdup of the Purity Supreme in Rozzy back in May of 1974. A 61-year-old patrolman was shot and killed during the robbery. Sparazza admitted to shooting patrolman Brown from the backseat of the getaway car driven by Ralph Petrozello. Paul M. Cook was convicted along with Sparazza and Petrozello, but alleged that Miles had provided them with the weapons for the robbery. The following year, the now five-time convicted murderer Sparazza was still facing allegations of perjury by Miles' defense team in the murder conviction appeal.
And Sparazza was still under witness protection.
And he was concerned about being charged with killing Stokes. Stokes was the fifth victim at that point. It's like, what did you care?
I don't know. That story's so weird. Now for the next heist. On Monday, April 20th, at a quarter after 5 in the evening, the First National Bank of Boston that was located in the Northgate Shopping Mall in Revere was robbed. As a bank teller and one of the Brink's guards were loading the deposit bags into the truck, the thieves appeared. The heist was complete in less than a minute. The Brink's guard was hit over the head and disarmed, while the bank employee and the other guard of the truck looked on helplessly. The three robbers were all wearing ski masks and armed with what witnesses said were M16s and automatic handguns. The vehicle the three men arrived in, a green camper truck, was abandoned as they were picked up by two more men in a white Ford Econoline van. The stolen .38 from the Brink's guard was found in the abandoned van about a mile away. The police determined that the men had then split up into two separate vehicles, which they found abandoned in Chelsea. But after that, the trail ran cold.
On April 30th, Richard Megna was arrested on charges of being the ringleader of the heist that had taken place just days earlier. He pleaded innocent in his arraignment hearing on May 3rd, but was held on $200,000 bail. Megna's attorney, Marty Lepo, vowed to get the bail reduced. In the meantime, Brink's was offering a $30,000 reward for information that would lead to the arrest and conviction of the perpetrators of the crime. Megna would later be listed as a suspect, one of dozens, in the Gardner Museum heist. If you want to hear more about Megna's early days, listen to The Gang That Couldn't Shoot Straight, which I believe was episode 41 from season 1.
That was a good episode, if I do say so myself. Okay, back to the Master Thieves.
Hey, don't steal Kirkjian's title there.
I was being facetious, and it was a bit of a nod to him anyway.
Okay, I have to bust your chops from time to time. I
had nothing better to do. Anyhow, 2 months later in June, two state police detectives acting on a tip from an informant entered a North Shore motel room at 2 in the morning to recover 23 paintings that had been stolen from a Newton home in February of 81. Amongst the recovered artwork was your and Richie's beloved Dolly, the Chagalls, and the Moreaus.
I'm quite partial to Chagall, his tapestries in particular. The biblical references are gorgeous.
Hey, too bad when we were in Jerusalem, we didn't get to see them.
I don't think they're on display like a museum. You have to be invited for a state function, and no one's going to invite us to a state function.
Oh, that's such a shame. Well, we'll have to make do with the photos. Back to the Chagall pieces. Just 10 hours after the recovery, Louis Royce was transferred from Leavenworth to Charles Street Jail. He entered an Alford plea to the judge, which meant that he admitted to that the prosecutor had enough evidence to likely convict him, but he didn't admit to the burglary. However, a mistrial was declared after Royce's attorney argued that he had the right to cross-examine the FBI informant, but the feds refused to disclose their informant's identity. And that leaves me thinking it was either Richie or someone I don't want to mention because he's still alive.
It is possible it was Dad. At least he was aware the paintings had been lifted. And remember, there was nothing in the paper about the house being robbed until after the paintings had been recovered. And it wouldn't be the first or the last time that the feds refused to expose Dad as the informant, or that a judge would refuse to put him on the stand, including in one of Stephen Rossetti's later cases in the early 2000s.
Yeah, that's because Richie was unreliable on the stand and the prosecution couldn't risk it.
Tainted testimony.
That was Judge Wolf, right?
Right.
Speaking of decades later, Royce claimed that it was he who gave up the rest of the loot to save Ralph Rossetti from a lengthy prison sentence, but that story makes no sense because if he was the informant, the feds would have opened their mouths.
True. Okay, back to 1982. In August, Megna was freed after the police told a grand jury that he was not involved in the April heist. Megna, quote, "I'm thinking about shaving my head and cutting off an arm to change my appearance. This is getting scary," end quote.
Talk about a drama queen. Quote, "Marty Lepo saved me again. One of these days, though, I'm not going to have anybody around me when something happens and I'm going to jail for life."
Instead, he went to Florida. Okay, we need to do an episode just on Marty Lepo next season.
Next season, for sure. Maybe some of the other attorneys.
Okay, from another that attorney era episode also like, would be good. Like we did in season one.
Yeah. Okay, the reason Megna was freed was that one of the crew members, Alan Del Verde, had made a deal with the authorities and confessed to his part in the heist.
Lucky him. At the end of the year, Ralph Rossetti and Richie Devlin were arrested on December 20th. Rossetti was at home and Devlin was arrested at Suffolk County Courthouse where he was testifying at another trial. Then just 2 days later, Souza, Stephen Rossetti, and Louis Royce were convicted for the 1980 Brinks job in Jamaica Plain. And remember that 13-year sentence that I mentioned earlier?
Hey, you said you weren't going to go there.
Okay, well, all I'm going to say is that the same Mark Rossetti who was given a 13-year sentence in February of 1980, just a little over 2 years into his sentence, was back on the street in time to have allegedly robbed the armored truck in April of 82. Granted, in those days, you usually maxed out at two-thirds because you were averaging 2.5 days of good time every week off your sentence. But 26 months isn't two-thirds of 13. And that's all that I'm going to say. Our listeners can draw their own conclusions. Anyhow, on January 3rd of 1983, Mark Rossetti was arrested at the Mass General Hospital for the Northgate Mall armored truck heist. He pleaded innocent the following day and bail was set at $20,000 without surety.
The trial began 6 months later in the summer of 83, and their case was a lock since Alan Del Verde had flipped. He had been released to a halfway house before the heist and was supposed to be doing work release, but instead he would spend his time stealing cars and hanging out with his girlfriend.
Well, not as exciting as what Devlin was doing when he was on his furlough taking down banks and stuff. But maybe he took his inspiration from Devlin before deciding to finger Devlin Rossetti and Stephen Rossetti. He said that Ralph did not take part in the robbery, but rather only scoped the place out.
That same month, all three Rossettis were convicted after less than 6 hours of deliberation, but Richie Nine Lives Devlin was found innocent. Mark was given a 5- and 10-year sentence to be served concurrently. Stephen received the same, but he was already serving 15 to 20 in Walpole for the 1980. Ralph was given a 5-year and a 7-year sentence to also run concurrently. They would later appeal their convictions, but would be denied in July of 85.
The following month, the first page of the Massachusetts State Charter was stolen from the State House, but Miles was still locked up at the time, so we can safely say that it wasn't him. The sketches of the two thieves were pretty nondescript, by the way.
Well, they didn't just grab the charter, they also made off with King Charles I's seal, and although the spotlight might not have been on Miles for the theft of those items, he was in the press for being granted a retrial in the murders of the two Quincy women back in 75. This is the case that never ends. Yes. It would take another 2 months until Miles was released on a $25,000 bond in October.
The retrial started in February of 85, but Miles mustn't have had a good feeling, so he jumped bail on the last day, failing to show up in court on Saturday, March 2nd. He testified in his own defense for 5 hours, accusing law enforcement of conspiring against him. Even though he pulled a runner, the jury acquitted him despite his absence the next day.
Meanwhile, the Massachusetts state charter was discovered in the closet of an apartment in Dorchester during a drug raid just 5 days later. In addition to the drugs that they had been looking for, 17 Oriental rugs and 37 weapons, including some vintage ones, were seized. A photo of Miles was discovered in another raid of Kevin Gilday's apartment in Canton that same day. The authorities determined that Miles had been in the apartment in Dorchester with the loot on February 20th.
Norfolk County DA William Delahunt told the press that he thought that the charter had been stolen for ransom. Trying to sell the charter would be like trying to sell a Mona Lisa. Why do they always think that there's nobody to buy these pieces?
Please, I just think it makes them feel better that there's still a chance that they'll recover it. In the meantime, Miles was still missing, although his mother had passed away on March 11th. He was finally arrested on Tuesday, July 9th at his late mother's home in Milton. He'd been on the lam for 4 months by then. The following day, he pleaded not guilty to jumping bail. In October, he changed his plea. His attorney, Marty Lepo, quipped that it was probably the first case of someone convicted of jumping bail after they had been acquitted. The judge sentenced Miles to the maximum sentence of 1 year. The following month, the court rejected his request to set him free, so he had to sit in the cooler until the summer of 1986.
Hey, doesn't Miles claim to be related to Emily Dickinson?
Yes. I can't remember where I read that, though, but I did have to look it up. You're more closely related to Emily than either Miles or me. You're fifth cousins. Both you and Emily descended from Elizabeth Treadway Hayward.
You may have won the Puritanical Award, but I won the Wasp Award on that one. And I guess that makes Miles our cousin.
Hey, I started working on his tree on Wiki, but enough of that for now. Okay, back to the charter. So no one was ever indicted for the stolen charter because neither Bellotti nor De La Hunt could come to an agreement over who had jurisdiction over what. The Rossettis were serving their time, and Richie was closed out as an informant by the feds for the millionth time.
After they spent all that time and money on a sustainability study. That's what it says in his 302 thing. What was he, like a freaking climate change project? How was that a sustainability study?
Well, he wasn't sustainable.
But they kept taking him back.
Our tax money hard at work. Okay, let's wrap this up.
Okay, there will be much, much more about Miles, the Rossettis, and Dad next season. Our next episode will be another Hit Parade 1. I think Hit Parade of 81, correct?
Hit Parade of 81.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. Bye.
Bye.